I am Rob Brooks, as Lee said, from Penn State, and I'd like to acknowledge my other co-authors, to my graduate students who contributed to this work. Both have moved on to jobs. And I do want to thank Lee for inviting me to this session. I know about half the folks in it, and I actually know about a dozen soil scientists here, so I don't feel too far out of as a fish out of water, as a wetland scientist, wildlife biologist here. I'd like to just mention our center, Riparia. We're celebrating 20 years, so we've been doing a lot of work through these years, and I need to acknowledge the folks that contributed funding to this set of projects I'm going to summarize here, as well as my crew back home in Riparia. So thanks to all of them. Just a bit of background. It's almost 25 years now since we've been getting calls to improve wetland performance in terms of mitigation and restoration. The National Research Council report way back, and then succeeding reports, some of which I have participated in, coming up now to the mitigation rule that was mentioned earlier in 2008. And frankly, we still are not there yet. So what I want to do is talk about some of the things we're doing to try to move us forward to get where we can be building much better wetlands. Those unfamiliar with the mitigation rule, they do recognize the importance of looking at a watershed context, prioritizing, I think, really the landscape placement of mitigation sites, and also the importance of monitoring both performance and using some standardized methods to do so. I just wanted to mention the current activities going on, kind of the politics of water and wetlands regulation. Proposed rule came out this year, at least officially, and is generating lots of comments. There is a companion report on the connectivity of streams and wetlands. It's not directed at mitigation, but there's a lot of excellent information in that synthesis, and I was part of the panel that reviewed that report, and the final version should be out very soon. But very controversial in terms of that proposed rule and what constitutes a jurisdictional wetland, at least from a federal perspective. There are sites out there. Unfortunately, some of them are in places that have chronic stressors, and this is when one of the problem that even if you do meet all the sort of water and soil requirements, you still may have placed it in a landscape that's inappropriate. I think there's tremendous opportunities of where to direct mitigation and restoration sites, such as these meander scars flooded here in North Dakota. So we have to do a much better job, and as was alluded to, we've been looking at this issue for 20 years or more, and a few years back came up with this simple model where we looked at the degradation sequence here from natural reference sites to a disturbed population, and then doing some studies on created restored populations. We said these two are equivalent, and that just shouldn't be. So if degraded natural wetlands, or our created wetlands, I should say, look like our degraded natural wetlands, we've got to do much better, and how can we push this up to get closer to those natural sites? The literature is replete with examples. This was a meta-analysis of 621 sites, mitigation sites worldwide. You can see their general conclusion that we're not replacing structure and function sufficiently. Our own work, which I'll talk about here, found the same thing. This was a study of this particular paper on 72 mitigation restoration sites. We actually looked at 120 overall. So how do we use data, which would be kind of my theme here, from reference wetlands to improve mitigation design and performance? A little bit of background on Riparia. We work in sort of an expanded mid-Atlantic region, if you will. And in Pennsylvania in particular, we've put together, over a 10-year period, 222 reference sites, different hydrogeomorphic classes in different ecoregions throughout Pennsylvania. And similar efforts are going on in other states within the mid-Atlantic. I'll mention that a little bit later. So how do we use this reference data? A lot of our work we put in the context of a disturbance response curve where we have anthropogenic disturbance across the bottom and some condition measure. This could be an index of biotic integrity, it could be a measure of soil condition, any biological, physical, or chemical measure that we might have. And we don't always know the relationship between disturbance and these particular measures. This is taken more or less from the tiered aquatic use approach that EPA is promoting, where we have a degradation of the ecosystem by any number of measures by various landscape and site stressors. I'll give you just a little bit of an example. One of our reference sites where we look at landscape impacts as well as site impacts. This work done by J.B. Moon on her dissertation work. You can see the right-hand one in an agricultural setting has a different land use, and in the detail work, there's lots of different stressors imposing there. This was pretty typical. What we find is there is a more frequent and more intense fluctuation in those hydrographs, drier soils, less forest cover in the system, impervious surface increases, and soil organic matter, which we've heard a lot about this morning, tends to decrease in these disturbed systems, probably because they are drying out, at least in our case. Very quickly, I wanted to mention another intensive method we have, the Floristic Quality Assessment Index. I think this is gaining some popularity around the country. Requires a fairly detailed species list. Sarah Chamberlain in our group has been doing the work, and she's actually come up with a calculator where if you drop in a species list here, it's showing up here, you get a scoring of the floristic quality assessment, and also I'll show you in a minute the Wentworth Index in terms of the hydrologic niche for those wetland plants. And a typical curve, this we find this FQAI to be very effective, and it's generally a linear response from relatively intact systems to highly disturbed. This is a measure of the plant IBI, which includes the FQAI score, and that's for multiple wetlands. So let's look at some of the data. This is Naomi Gibo's master's work comparing natural reference sites using the same method to mitigation projects. And in general, the issues were not mimicking the structure and function, partly because we're not putting them in the right places. We're not using the same methods to evaluate them, so we wanted to do that. We're often not matching the soil conditions, particularly when we're excavating, as we saw in a couple of cases, into the mineral soil. And very often we're not avoiding those chronic stressors that keep setting back that wetland over and over. In her case, she looked very closely at landscape disturbance, and I have a series of graphs, the box and whisker plots that are the same here, mitigation sites on the left, reference here, significance level. So we had a landscape disturbance index, increasing disturbance down here, and very highly significantly different for those mitigation sites in where they are relative to the reference wetlands. Something I don't recommend normally, but we took all the 10 HGM functions, hydrogeomorphic functions, and lumped them together just to see what would happen. Reference standards are our best sites based on best professional judgment. Those are higher than the reference sites, which are much higher than the mitigation sites in terms of that function. Breaking it down, looking at the plant community for a second, three different kinds of wetlands in every case. The plant community is showing a loss of specialists, more generalists, more invasives, pretty much across the board. It doesn't matter. Soil organic matter, just looking at two systems here, depressions, quite a significant difference here. Significant in fringing wetlands, where it's a little easier, I think, to bring the hydrology into a proper level, but still some differences there. And just to show you another one in terms of other functions, wildlife habitat in general for 10 species falling off in all four types of wetlands. So based on that study, obviously we want to mimic the hydrology, and we're going to be, we have some preliminary discussions with Lee and Rich about wet bud and how that can contribute to our design hydrographs, which I'll show you in a minute. Again, picking a landscape setting where we're avoiding those chronic stressors. Many soils are going to require amendments. We did some amendment studies years ago. There's some continuing you heard about this morning. Very important to try to somehow get back to sufficient carbon as well as sufficient water to make the system function. And again, trying to compare apples to apples here in terms of the assessment methods. One way we're doing that, we've decided to put all of our reference data on a website. We think this can help with design and mitigation, also evaluating performance of these sites. And basically each of the variables has a tile. And if we take biomass, which is kind of a synthetic variable of other measures, you can see its performance against the disturbance score here. And for various ecoregions, the response is somewhat different, but in general, there's a downward trend. So for this particular variable, doesn't matter, this is it. It's based on all these other measures of the vegetation. And for each of these tiles, then, you can scroll over and you get a definition, you get the numerics dealing with the visual portrayal here. You can break out the best of the sites, the reference standard sites, compare those to the other sites. And just in this example here, looking at organic matter, you see for slope wetland, our typical organic matter is just over 10 versus some of our depressions, which at least the best sites should be closer to 30% soil organic matter. That's a huge difference. You can move these tiles around. Right now, you can also turn them into a numeric table that would be more helpful to the specifications when you're actually trying to design and implement a project. And I will mention where we are in this the reference database in just a second. One of the pieces, we've done three workshops, and one of the pieces we heard from practitioners is we need the hydrology data more accessible. So we're working on how to put hydrographs and those data into the database where it doesn't fit quite as well. But I wanted to show you some of the data we have. This is done by Kristen Hitchka. We've heard a lot about our 0 to 30 centimeters in terms of saturation. These two sites we consider the best of the best, and you can see this is a over a 10-year period, 6 to 12-hour data compressed here. Most of the time it's in that critical range. This site kind of intermediate. These sites are distressed and much more flashy, much more time outside of that critical time that Mike was talking about earlier. In Kristen's project, we were fortunate, I guess, to have a period of drought and a period of wet years. So comparing those, if we look at a reference site in a dry year versus one of these non-reference standard disturbed sites, at the end of that year in the growing season, that level is approaching the bottom of the 30 centimeters but hasn't left it, whereas the disturbed site, much, much drier. And in the wet year where we have, and this is precipitation up here, saturated to the surface in the reference site, disturbed site, maybe 50% in a wet year in that critical zone. So we're trying to take these kinds of data and put the raw data up so people can use it for different kinds of wetlands in different kinds of ecoregions. Our rollout plan is as follows. The Pennsylvania data is basically there except for these supplements we're talking about. It's sort of in beta it's beyond beta testing at this point. It should be publicly available very soon. You can actually find it if you hunt around. We're doing Delaware next, then West Virginia, Virginia, and we expect to have over 1,000 reference sites for the Mid-Atlantic with these kinds of data available for practitioners. We have done three workshops. And we wanted to listen to those that build wetlands, consultants, to some extent the agency folks on the ground, and we're taking their comments and trying to improve the website, the database, so it's as useful as possible. I just want to show you a couple of sites here and how we can use some of these data. This is a site that was built in 1990. This is an older photograph. This is what it looked like a year ago, 23 years later. I'm going to use a floristic quality assessment report and just show you over time how things have changed. So if we look at the floristic quality assessment index, when it was planted, it was quite high. These are the reference data, and of course we didn't even have these data then, but looking back retrospectively, they had a pretty good plant list. 1 year later, that score being much, much lower, the plants didn't survive, they didn't do well at all. But back in 2008, when we looked at it, it's starting to approach what natural reference sites might have. In the same way, looking at the Wentworth Index, this is where an obligate wetland plant gets a 1, an obligate upland plant gets a 5, so the lower number the better. Again, with the original planted list, probably on target for the design of the site, a year later, it wouldn't even be considered jurisdictional, at least from the plant community perspective, but by 2008, through a lot of colonization and volunteer plants, it's coming back better. Looking at a second site that I think was designed much more technically accurate, thanks to the WHM group who did this site, a lot of plans, a lot of hydrologic analysis, planting plan that was pretty sophisticated, actually a fairly good site, slope wetland at the toe of the slope. That's what it looks like a couple years ago. Same kinds of data. The planted actually equaled the reference standard plant list, the higher score for the floristic quality assessment index. Again, they did not have access to that, but it would be accessible now. In 2003, we happened to do that site, and it had fallen off somewhat, showing improvement, at least getting very close to some of the other natural reference wetlands, which I think is quite an accomplishment. Somewhat disturbing trend, though, is the wetness index of the plant community is getting drier over time, still acceptable below a 3, but something to keep an eye on. It's important to notice that there was a... sorry, that's my timer. And I think we need to use these kinds of data and get it out in the hands of practitioners, combined with a required monitoring plan that calls upon using the same kind of assessment data from the beginning, and hopefully we can build some better wetlands. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. We have time for a couple questions if we have any.
Go ahead.
As a soil scientist, I'm just curious. I understand your interest in the plants, but what if you went back to making measurements on saturation, the hydrology, and anaerobic conditions, and you found that your restored site met the hydrology conditions and it was becoming anaerobic? But you had a problem with your plants. 1 year later, they all died or something. From your perspective, would you be willing to assume that if the anaerobic conditions are there, the saturation is there, that in time an appropriate plant community would come back, and so you could say this is a successful site, or do you think that you'd rather almost ignore the saturation anaerobic conditions and just focus on the plants?
No, I'm just using the plants as an indicator of getting that system back to a higher functioning level. My concerns, you definitely want to pay attention to the levels of saturation. In the first site, I showed an example. We had some data from that. We did some soil amendment projects on that, which I can't get into now. But my concern, if the plant community is showing a falling off like that, is you either have an invasive problem or you didn't get the hydrology right, in some cases too wet, in some cases too dry. And that's why we're opening up a dialogue between some of these kind of using our as many reference hydrographs as we can come up with for different regions, and then use something like WetBud to kind of predict the hydrology of the site. So we're doing a much better job of choosing the site to begin with and then making sure the hydrology is going to be sufficient for the kind of wetland you have in mind. So you know, as in most wetland studies, you got to pay attention to plants, soils, and water throughout the whole system.
One more real quick. Jacob.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that you're going to have over 1,000 sites, which is outstanding. And I was just wondering if you could speak briefly to challenges in terms of the way that the different states in the different data sets do things like wetland classification and your other data streams.
Fortunately, it's a good question. Fortunately for the Mid-Atlantic states, we have a very active wetland working group, MOG, and for the most part, we're on the same page in terms of hydrogeomorphic classification. That group developed a classification paper, so we're standard there. What was a problem, which is delayed implementation of the other states, whose data I have, is that because the methods are slightly different, we can't throw them all into the same mix. So each, you have to dial up each individual state, the particular type of wetland, and the ecoregion. So you have three things to pick up. So now we have to incorporate the each state's data in a unique way, and it's not trivial for all the variables, so that's what's slowing us down, which we didn't anticipate. But I still think it's going to be incredibly useful. Thank you.
Thanks.